Welcome to Rounds with the Investigators, Multiple Myeloma Edition. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. We asked five community-based medical oncologists, Drs. Warren Brenner, Charles Farber, Stephen Hagar, Gracie Joshua, and Raymond Lobins, to come to our recording studio in Miami and present challenging cases from their practices to four clinical investigators, Drs. Rafia Fonseca, Ravi Vij, Jeff Zonder, and Jeff Wolf. To begin, Dr. Fonseca and Vij field cases, beginning with a patient from the practice of Dr. Lobins.
This is actually one of my favorite patients. Everybody has favorite patients, but I didn't see her initially. She's a 51-year-old female. She works at Walmart, single, no kids, strong family with a brother. And she developed this right hip pain where she couldn't work anymore. And this was in late July of 2009. She went to the hospital to get assessed, and they found this lesion in her bone. And when they found the lesion in the bone, they found this big uterine mass. And they said, oh, this must be uterine cancer. And they shipped her out of the hospital to a hospital that did OB-GYN. So the OB-GYN did a surgery and pulled out this uterine mass, which turned out to be benign. And so they did a mammogram, and they found a mass in her breast. And so they had to do that surgery. Turned out to be benign. So they said, well, you don't have anything uterine. Go back there and get it worked out. So she came back. And we worked her up, and she had a total protein of 10.1, albumin 2.0. Her normal creatinine was 0.7, calcium was normal. Her SPEP showed a IgG kappa of 3.7 grams. Her kappa lambda was 128 and 17, her beta 2 microglobulin 3.4. Her bone survey showed multiple lesions. It was positive in the right and left pelvis, the right and left femurs, the skull, and the eighth rib. And her biopsy was variable, but about 30 to 80%, so there about 70% of those were plasma cells.
So maybe just first, Rafael, I'm curious about the confusion. This seems like not rare in myeloma to have a situation where it's thought to be something else. How typical or atypical is this story from that perspective?
Unfortunately, it's actually quite typical. And I've seen a fair number of patients like this where, you know, the diagnostic workup either leads somewhere else and then turns out not to be, and then they go back and they find myeloma. Perhaps the worst example I've seen is someone who had a non-secretor myeloma who had unexplained renal failure and, you know, failed to be diagnosed. So it is just a short answer. It's an unfortunate but not so rare situation.
So, Ravi, what would you be thinking about in terms of the short and longer term treatment plan for this lady?
So she's 51, seems like she's had no previous medical problems, and performance status, if good, I would try to ultimately have autologous stem cell transplant as one of the therapeutic options to offer her, and so would be thinking of an induction that would not impair my ability to collect stem cells. I'm still a proponent of trying to do stem cell transplantation as part of initial therapy, so I usually give a finite period of induction, anywhere from 3 to 6 cycles. And so these days, the most common regimen that I give is bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. And the few patients that have renal insufficiency is where I substitute the Mayo Clinic favorite of bortezomib, cyclophosphamide, dexamethasone. I try to avoid the lenalidomide there.
And Rafael, you know, we have this survey going out to 25 myeloma investigators. And of course, one of the questions is, what's your typical pre-transplant induction? And I see your answer is a little bit different than most people's.
Mm-hmm.
Cyborg D.
Well, you know, it's a regimen we have a lot of experience with and we like to use for a number of reasons. It's a regimen you can give within 15 minutes of deciding that you need to start a patient on therapy. And as Ravi was commenting on, it's something that it's independent of your renal function and perhaps theoretical. But one advantage I like is that I think we're likely to see more and more the treatment of myeloma evolve more to chronic long-term treatment. And allowing patients to reach a post-transplant state where they're lenalidomide naive gives me sort of the comfort that, you know, the patient yet sees another very active agent that they haven't seen before with minimal tumor bulk. And again, perhaps this is only theoretical at this point, but it does allow you to use that regimen, which, again, you can do right away. Arguably, it's a very cheap regimen as well, too, and one that is very well tolerated by patients. So that would be our number one choice, Cyborg-D. But if someone decided, you know, like Dr. Vij does, the RVD, that would be a perfectly acceptable regimen and one that has a very, very high level of activity.
And Ravi, I'll go back to you. And you're saying you would be thinking about transplant. Would you be also open to collecting cells and delaying transplant?
I would be open to it. I think that though there's no prospective data in the era of new agents, I don't think the paradigm has changed, that delaying transplant till first progression will offer hopefully the same overall survival advantage, though the event-free survival will almost certainly be shorter. However, take issue with those that extrapolate that data to state that you could delay transplant to fourth or fifth progression and still get a similar benefit. I think that, yes, transplant in short term does produce some morbidity, and if you are going to do it anyway, may want to do it at a time when it provides potentially sometimes a few years progression-free, rather than delaying it to your last line of therapy when you may get 6 months out of the procedure. Patients will feel often cheated that it took them 3 months to recover fully, and then their disease is progressing.
Raphael?
Well, myself, like Dr. Veach, I'm actually a proponent of transplant being part of the initial strategy for most patients. I have some slides that I use now in educational events that the title states myeloma is a curable disease. And the reason I say that is because of a paper that was published over the last 6 to 8 months from a Spanish group that looked at the very long-term outcomes of myeloma patients treated with stem cell transplant, where they show in a pretty definitive way that at 20 years, about 10% of patients are cured from their myeloma with a single autologous transplant. Now, mind you, this is a study that looked at very long-term outcomes, patients treated in the 1980s and 1990s, so many of them getting what we would consider nowadays suboptimal induction therapy, and yet they get into that 10%. And the math is very simple. It's 30% of the 30% of patients that got into a CR. Well, now we can get a lot more patients into CR before transplant and certainly after transplant. So my thought is that, in fact, there's going to be a growing number of patients that are going to have durable remissions with an optimal induction, stem cell transplant, and plus or minus some form of maintenance treatment.
So Raymond, how was she treated systemically and what happened with the hip?
Okay. For clarification-wise, there was about a four-month delay from her initial presentation to where we found her, and she was wheelchair-bound at that time, and she would always come in with her brother. So we treated her with lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone initially, and she did not tolerate it at all. Her biggest complaint actually was intractable diarrhea.
Let me go to Ravi. What would you be thinking about in this situation where she's having a lot of diarrhea with RVD?
Well, I think that the more likely offending agent would possibly be bortezomib, though lenalidomide too can cause diarrhea. I would certainly give her a little bit of a break and then try to first, perhaps if the patient was getting full dose twice weekly bortezomib, perhaps try to cut down to once weekly, and if patient was getting it intravenously, perhaps give it subcutaneous, see if that made a difference. But it's a matter of trial and error.
Ravi, what about the issue of sub-Q and weekly bortezomib?
So I have adopted subcutaneous bortezomib as the manner in which I administer the drug for most part. I've had good results in terms of tolerability. There are very few local injection site reactions. It certainly does cut down the neuropathy risk. It doesn't eliminate it.
Just to clarify, when you say you use it, or for example, are you using it sub-Q in RVD?
Correct. Whenever I give bortezomib, I administer it subcutaneous.
And what schedule do you use when you're using it with RVD?
Generally, I start out with the usual twice weekly administration at 1.3 milligram per meter square for 2 weeks and then a week off. I will be open to reducing the dose after 2 to 4 cycles if the patient has had a good response. I think that introducing it once weekly in a person who otherwise should be able to tolerate it twice weekly at the outset perhaps will not be the optimal therapy. Certainly in the context of a 3-drug regimen, it has been shown that bortezomib given once weekly is as good as being given twice weekly. However, I think one has to view the data with a slightly different lens sometimes than it is often portrayed as. What if you had a drug that you could tolerate twice weekly and you did not end up getting a cumulative dose that would have been cut in half, though you didn't intend to? And then you would possibly have had better response rates if you were able to administer it twice weekly. The reason why the Palumbo data showed that once weekly was as good as twice weekly was that the cumulative dose delivered was the same, whether you intended to give it twice weekly. So I think that we do need to take that also into consideration.
So I want to get back to this case, but just briefly, Raphael, what's your position in terms of sub-Q and weekly bortezomib?
So for the past 2 years, I haven't prescribed ever bortezomib without concurrent cyclophosphamide. We very quickly moved to the weekly regimen with all of the caveats and the considerations that Dr. Vish mentioned, but we have moved to that. So the first question was, yes, we moved to weekly. It made it quite a bit simpler on patients and our providers as well, too, knowing that patients, instead of getting quote-unquote cycles, will get 16 weeks of CyberD induction therapy. So that made everyone's life simpler. And then when the question came to sub-Q, we have moved on then from weekly IV to a number of our patients now getting weekly sub-Q. It's part of our standard orders.
So Raymond, this lady's having diarrhea. After how many cycles was she having, incidentally?
First cycle, she had her diarrhea was so bad, she says, I never want that again. So I changed her to lenalidomide and dexamethasone for 4 more cycles. And clinically, she had a tremendous improvement of her quality of life.
And you said she was in a wheelchair. What was that from specifically?
That's from the hip pain.
The hip pain.
Right.
How did that do with the treatment?
Her hip pain completely went away and she started to not only walk around, she went back to work full time.
I see she got radiation therapy also.
Yes, she did get radiation
therapy. When was
that
given?
That was given right away when we started treatment.
Was there something there that looked like it was going to fracture? Or was it more for the pain?
She did have an impending fracture on her right femoral neck. And so that had to be stabilized, and that's why she had the radiation.
So just to flip back to Ravi, what do you think about radiation therapy in this kind of situation?
If a patient has an impending fracture, we certainly get an orthopedic opinion and make sure they don't want to prophylactically do surgical stabilization. And then if they do, then we give post-operative radiation therapy in that scenario. I have, obviously, in patients who have acute pain and the surgeon thinks that you do not need surgical stabilization, gone ahead with radiation. And concurrent use of bortezomib or lenalidomide-based regimens with radiation is well-tolerated. I think there's some anecdotal data that if you're giving bortezomib and you have radiating an area in the head and neck region, that there may be some extra sensitization occurring, but I don't know what Rafael's kind of...
Well, you know, we like you, we tend to be very, very conservative with the use of radiation therapy just because one of the main issues now is with increasing longevity of the patients, having them being able to produce enough cells over time. So we do the same thing, you know, consultation with a surgeon. If there's painful in this patient in a wheelchair, I think that, you know, without having seen the patient, I would say almost for certain we would have done the same thing, you know, irradiated the person. But just the word of caution is, again, radiation should be used mostly for very focal problems and rarely in an extended field fashion for myeloma patients.
So now when you started out with this patient, you were talking to her about a transplant in the future?
Yes, we sent her M-spike nadir at 0.9, and after this would have been her fifth cycle, I sent her to Cleveland Clinic, the person I work with there, and assessed for a transplant, and they were all for transplant, and she said, absolutely not.
What was her thinking?
She was scared to death of the transplant. She just said, I feel great. You're absolutely not going to do a transplant right now, maybe later. And she didn't even collect stem cells.
Hmm. So what happened next?
She did well, and I put her on lenalidomide maintenance, and she did well until March of 2011. And all of a sudden, the other leg started to hurt, the left leg. And so we did an MRI of her spine and also of her hip, and we found that she had multiple spine lesions now, L1 to L4, with L4 having some collapse, as well as lesions in that left hip and femoral neck, which the lesions in the hip were there before, but they have clearly grown in size. She also is having an increase in her M-spike, and although it wasn't a significant increase in her M-spike, she was clearly progressed and symptomatic again.
So, Ravi, what would you be thinking at that point?
Well, I think that she is progressing. I would restage her disease. And at this time, she needs to, again, be consulted on as to whether she is more open to transplant. And I think that though she's had a fair amount of lenalidomide, I would still not be averse to trying to collect stem cells. There's always the concern in patients who've had a lot of lenalidomide that you may fail to do so. If she is willing to consider transplant, I usually give, once again, a salvage regimen for perhaps a more abbreviated course, 2 to 3 cycles instead of 4 to 6.
Which regimen?
I think in her case, obviously, she's, you know, had problems with bortezomib before. If I could convince her to dose modify it and try to give it once weekly, subcutaneous, as I said, we would perhaps be able to get by, and that would be my first choice.
Bortezomib, however, with what else?
I would give bortezomib and dexamethasone. That would be my choice.
And Rafael, what would you be thinking at this point?
Along the same lines, I probably would have considered something like the risk of sounding like a broken record, bortezomib with dexamethasone and cyclophosphamide, CyberD.
And that's actually what you did, right?
Yeah, I use HebroD.
And like Dr. Vish, I would have the discussion again. And again, there's some patients that for personal or professional reasons, I think it's okay to the first stem cell transplant. But you're in your early 50s, I would try to twist your arm again now.
So maybe you can bring us up to date. And the thing that really attracted my attention is when he put in the note, I would want to test the cerebrin levels. So we'll get to that in a second.
So we talked again with the person I used for transplant, and I kind of twisted her arm a little bit, and I gave her CyBorD with sub-Q bortezomib instead of the IV bortezomib, and this was really strong with the anti-diarrheal medicines, and she actually did pretty well. So I gave her three cycles of that and then sent her back to Cleveland Clinic. And
no more diarrhea?
She did have some, but was tolerable now. And she had a transplant done on February 1st of this year, and she's recovering from that. And then I put in my note, in a perfect world, which we're not in right now, I would get a cerebrin level, and I would say, okay, is this patient going to respond to an IMID or not going to respond to an IMID? And if she is going to respond to an IMID, I would look for a maintenance trial with pomalidomide. And if she wasn't going to respond to the IMID, I'd look for a maintenance trial with carfilzomib.
So, Raphael, can you talk a little bit about cerebrin levels?
Yes, of course. And this is absolutely a fascinating discussion because it's just something that was recently discovered. One of my colleagues, Keith Stewart, made the observation. And it turns out the name comes out because of the implications of the gene on brain development. But it seems to be the target gene for mechanism of action of IMIDs, both initially in teratogenesis, but now, as we know as well, in functioning of IMIDs as antineoplastic agents as well, too.
So this came up in terms of thalidomide causing birth defects, correct?
Well, yeah, the story is actually quite interesting because when Keith saw the paper, which was published in Science by this Japanese group, he thought, gee, I'm sure someone else is doing this, but turns out not. And so he went after this opportunity, which has tremendous potential value in the clinic, to find out that, in fact, cereblon is a main mediator of your responsiveness to IMIDs.
What exactly is the pathway or cerebrum? What is
I guess I know more about it than I can talk now because Keith is working on the next paper. But what he has been able to show, and we have several cases now, if you have low levels of expression or if you have deletion of the gene, you know, there's going to be a pretty high likelihood of you being not responsive to the drug. And in fact, he's doing more work along those lines and trying to come up with some way of converting this into a clinical assay.
Now, this is an assay on sera?
No, the original assays were done on the gene. So it was done by CGH and or sequencing that, you know, you look at the actual gene to be deleted. It would be ideal to have a functional assay of the gene or downstream consequences of the gene to know if this is going to work or not. But all the data I've seen now in our lab meetings just continues to show that very strong correlation between the level of the gene and, again, ultimately the activity and responsiveness to the drug.
And this is also thought to be the way thalidomide causes teratogenesis?
Yes, and that's the reason it was published in Science. So it's known that the teratogenicity has to do with the lack of growth of blood vessels, and therefore limbs cannot develop. But why did that occur was not known, and it has to do with the binding of the IMIDs with a cereblon gene product. So that seems to be the major determinant of responsiveness to IMIDs. And I guess there's two things. One is, could that be used as a predictive marker? But potentially even more important, could you actually figure out a way to go downstream after that? Because, you know, patients who get IMIDs, many of them, they have an imatinib-like picture in their clinical scenario. Some patients can go on for years and years, but most patients, unlike imatinib, I think the rate of refractory state is greater. It probably has to do with a greater genomic instability in myeloma than there is probably in CML. If you could figure out a way downstream of that, then potentially you could revert the activity of cereblon and then maybe have those patients respond again.
So just for practical purposes, Ray's talking about trying to find a trial of the next generation IMID pomalidomide or the new irreversible proteasome inhibitor, carfilzomib. Any trials out there, Ravi, looking at these agents that can be accessed from the community?
As far as maintenance therapy goes, there are, I know, trials with carfilzomib that are about to start. In fact, I think the Mayo Clinic has got a trial that is currently going through the regulatory framework, which we are going to be working with them on. As far as pomalidomide goes, I'm not aware personally of any maintenance studies ongoing.
Neither am I.
What would you be thinking post-transplant with this lady, Raphael?
Well, it's kind of interesting because one would want to know those molecular features. It's reported at diagnosis her genetics were normal. So I'm assuming this is normal. But when you're 50, you know, you have to just give her the benefit of the doubt. And if she was still IMID responsive, you know, post-transplant, which she could be, because you might be getting rid of different clones, which we could spend another hour talking about things. One could consider, you know, if you had a way to measure the cerebellum, then consider putting her on an IMiD. If you say, well, I can't do that and I'm going on clinical grounds alone, the other option would be bortezomib, but she's really limited because of the previous toxicity. So my first reaction would be to put her on expectant observation only if there's no available clinical trial.
Would you add a steroid with that because she failed lenalidomide maintenance already?
I think that's a good consideration. Some people have different thoughts about this, but I don't really consider therapeutic difference in intensity in maintenance versus first line, with the caveat that some patients can't tolerate the 25 milligrams, but I know there's some hypothetical concern that if you use lower doses, you might be creating resistance as well too, like you would with low-dose antibiotics. Again, purely hypothetical, but I think a rational sort of thought process. So I actually try to go higher on the doses of IMiDs when I put patients on maintenance.
Ravi, can you comment in general about the issue of post-transplant maintenance and where we are today and where you are today about this?
I think that the field is coming around. There are still some holdouts to the consensus that some kind of maintenance is perhaps going to benefit patients long-term. The majority of the data exists with lenalidomide. The data from the CLGB study is due to be published in the New England Journal of Medicine soon. This showed a definitive survival advantage. The French data from the IFM study, however, was only progression-free survival, no survival advantage. So there's been a lot of talk about why these two contradictory results. The French study had certainly some differences compared to the US study. Those patients in the French study, half of them received etoposide-containing and Adriamycin-containing regimens that are potentially more toxic and possibly genotoxic as well. They all received a consolidation phase of lenalidomide and dexamethasone. 20% of them got tandem transplants. So perhaps their more aggressive treatment up front may have obviated the need for maintenance. But I think it is something that we have to follow to really find out what. So from my own practice, I would say I give lenalidomide. At this moment, I restrict it to 2 years post-transplant. However, a lot of people do take issue with the fact that the CLGB study was a study where lenalidomide was given for the duration of the benefit till patients progressed. And the other thing is bortezomib, which, as I said, has also been shown in a trial done by the HOVON cooperative group when used pre and post-transplant to offer a survival advantage with pretty impressive benefit even in high-risk subgroups. So that is where I incorporate bortezomib in addition to lenalidomide. If patients have renal insufficiency at diagnosis, that's another group that I favor bortezomib maintenance, sometimes instead of lenalidomide maintenance, especially if their renal insufficiency is persistent after the transplant. That was another subgroup in the HOVON study that seemed to benefit a lot by bortezomib maintenance, those that had renal insufficiency going into it. But I think if you poll five different doctors, you'll get five different answers on this issue.
Robbie, what about the issue of post-transplant maintenance in a patient in CR?
So I think that the data from the thalidomide days seem to suggest that the benefit of maintenance thalidomide was perhaps limited to patients who were not in CR post-transplant. This was more a retrospective look at their study. With the data from lenalidomide, at least the French have analyzed for progression-free survival very robustly, and it seems like the benefit is irrespective of whether you're in CR or not. Obviously, they haven't seen a survival advantage. The CLGB study data, I think, still needs more in-depth analysis as to these more surrogate endpoints as to whether those patients, everybody benefits or not. However, in my practice, at this moment, I give everybody lenalidomide irrespective of whether they're in a CR or not.
So, Rafael, what's your non-protocol approach to maintenance, and what do you tell patients about risk of second cancers?
So, well, first of all, in maintenance, I guess the beauty and the challenge in medicine is that when the answers come in, they're always incomplete and obsolete in many ways, right? So it's really hard to know what to do with maintenance. I've sort of become somewhat tiered on how I approach maintenance in that if a patient has high risk, no matter what, I'll put them in a maintenance that contains some form of proteasome inhibitor, especially if they tolerate it well. That's one option. Now, if a patient is in a stringent CR, and we're seeing more and more of those patients, and perhaps as we move into the future into cerebral and testing, flow cytometry, MRD, if a patient is in a CR I personally doubt there's a lot of benefit. And this is for the non-high risk, of course, but there's a lot of benefit from maintenance. And anything else in between, I would provide maintenance with lenalidomide. But you can see, of course, how that story could get very complicated, because to do that study, you need almost like a 3x3 arm clinical study that stratifies on high risk and not high risk. And, you know, we kind of throw the data and say, this is what the data shows here, there, and that. But as we're moving more and more into this area of personalized medicine, it's a cliche, but every patient will be different. And I think, to the chagrin of some, you know, still think some of those things are being done somewhat at the discretion of the treating physician. And I think it's rarely one of us that would be able to waive sort of all the, you know, the Bibles of clinical evidence-based medicine to say that this is what you must do. So it is very challenging, but that's what I do. So high risk, proteasome-based, some form of maintenance, stringent CR, discussing with the patient, but considering deferral of further treatment, residual disease, further treatment with lenalidomide, and that's what we're doing.
And what do you say to patients about second cancers?
So I think as time has gone by, there's a growing evidence of an increased number of secondary malignancies in patients who receive IMiDs, but the absolute magnitude is small enough that it really hasn't changed in any substantial way how we practice the prescription of those medications. I do discuss it with patients and tell them about some data that's coming forward. It's still limited, and I don't think that the case is closed, but most of us feel that there is going to be an increased signal, but the magnitude is such that it's really not changing how we're thinking about the use or not of these medications.
If patients press you for a number in terms of risk, what kind of numbers do you give them? What kinds of second cancers?
I like to categorize things probably in more sort of percentage brackets. And I think in the less than 5% absolute increase, you know, when you look at the total number of series, there sure enough is going to be second cancers. You know, how to count those solid malignancies versus myelodysplasia and leukemia, I'm not sure it makes a lot of sense to put everything together. And that's why I use that number of under 5%.
Any other questions you want to throw out there, Raymond?
Yeah, just on this one case, just for your guidance. And this is a person that has failed maintenance lenalidomide and doesn't like the proteasome inhibitors, and also hasn't fully recovered from the transplant, may not be very keen on maintenance therapy when it's brought up to her. When she relapses, what treatment would you be giving her? I was thinking maybe bendamustine and a steroid, but is there anything better that you guys could think of?
I guess my hope would be pomalidomide would be available by then, and that might be an option because it can work. I mean, she did well, but ultimately progressed on that, and maybe by then we have the cerebellum testing, but that would be sort of my first reaction. The other one, it would be interesting to know what some of those GI toxicities are like in patients who are previously intolerant with a new proteasome inhibitor, so we might have the option of carfilzomib as well.
Robbie, can you talk about carfilzomib, but also the new oral proteasome inhibitor, MLN-9708, that was presented at ASH?
So I think carfilzomib certainly is pending accelerated approval request before the FDA. If it gets accelerated approval, it would be approved, I think, as per the protocol indication for patients who have seen both bortezomib, an immunomodulatory drug, and a relapse and refractory to their last line of therapy. In that scenario, I think the data presented seems to suggest that it does have activity even in bortezomib refractory patients, with a 19% response rate in patients who had received bortezomib as their last line of therapy, with several of those patients having had bortezomib combinations as their last line of therapy. And I think that once the drug gets licensed, it is more likely to be used in combination, at least with dexamethasone, where I expect the response rates to be better. Also, there is emerging data that perhaps doses higher than what have been submitted to the FDA for approval may have even higher response rates. So I think, in my mind, it should be an option that we could offer in patients who have failed bortezomib or are intolerant or bortezomib as well. There's a number of other trials looking at it in even upfront treatment where the data seems very intriguing. The oral proteasome inhibitor is very encouraging. The combination data with lenalidomide and dexamethasone with the oral proteasome inhibitor once again showed nearly 100% response rates in untreated patients. So I think the field is looking for an oral proteasome inhibitor. Oral drugs for chronic diseases, even given the caveats of sometimes us being concerned about compliance, are a preferred form of drug administration.
What do we know in terms of the side effects profile of carfilzomib? First of all, in terms of neuropathy, but also dyspnea and hyperglycemia have been reported.
So as far as neuropathy goes, I can say with a great deal of confidence that it has very little, I wouldn't say none, but it has very little signal in terms of neuropathy. There it is qualitatively different and quantitatively different than the existing proteasome inhibitor bortezomib. As regards the dyspnea, I think that is something that has been observed. It is still unclear as to what the cause may be. Some people have postulated that, especially at the higher doses where it is perhaps been seen in a little more patients, it may actually be the hydration that is given that may be contributing to it. But whether there's a capillary leak or a cytokine release phenomenon may be another thing. I don't think there's any conclusive evidence to suggest that the drug itself has any pulmonary or cardiac toxicity per se at the moment. As regards hyperglycemia, I think that, to my knowledge, the drug doesn't have any signal in that regard. Perhaps the 4 milligrams of dexamethasone they got with their pre-medication in their first cycle may have caused it, but I haven't seen it.
Ravi, what are your thoughts about Raymond's question about bendamustine in his patient?
It's a drug that I use frequently. I think in patients who have exhausted proteasome inhibition and the available immunomodulatory drugs, if they're not eligible for clinical trials, my preference is either for bendamustine or for high-dose cyclophosphamide. High-dose cyclophosphamide, I think, is cheaper. However, perhaps a little more in the way of side effects, more alopecia. But certainly, an alkylating agent is what I would like to turn to, and bendamustine is sort of a hybrid alkylating agent.
Rafael, any comments about the oral proteasome inhibitor, MLN, and other than being oral, any other potential advantages?
No, from what we know, that's the main advantage, just the route of administration. So the very specific potential advantage, apart from the convenience, is for the use long-term, as Dr. Vish was saying, when it comes to maintenance strategies.
I thought that there was like a lack of neuropathy.
Yeah, that is one thing that was observed, that though it is a boronate, it has not got a neuropathy signal. So that brings up the question as to why bortezomib has a neuropathy signal.
Although in fairness, the data is still limited, but that may be a signal for that too.
Getting back to pomalidomide, Rafael, if the drug were available right now, how would you use it?
I probably would use it for patients who have been previously exposed to lenalidomide. It seems to be very effective. I've participated in the clinical trials we have run at Mayo. Now we've treated probably hundreds of patients across our various sites, and it does have activity where sometimes lenalidomide was not working anymore. I don't know if it's any better or any worse that I would consider earlier on, but right now as a strategy, I probably would leave it for the lenalidomide refractory patient.
Okay, Gracie, can you present your patient?
This is a 79-year-old male. He was referred to me because of mild anemia. His hemoglobin was between 10 and 11. He also had macrocytosis. During his workup, I found that he had hypogammaglobulinemia. So I checked his urine, which showed a monoclonal protein with an M spike of 85. And he had serum free light chain, which was increased. It was kappa, and the ratio was also increased. Beta 2 microglobulin was 3.6. His creatinine was normal. His skeletal survey showed lytic lesions in the skull, both femurs and both humerus. His bone marrow showed hypercellular marrow with about 80% plasma cells. The FISH assay showed gains of chromosomes 7, 9, and 11.
So before you continue on, first of all, any comments about his general health, comorbidities?
Nothing unusual. He's a pretty active man. He was walking every day. I believe he had a well-controlled hypertension, but other than that, he was in pretty good health.
So, Rafael, how would you be thinking through this case and any specific reaction to the FISH assays?
Sure. I see things a lot sort of towards that slant always, and it caught my attention right away because he has 3 trisomies that are the common trisomies for hyperdiploid multiple myeloma. And this is your textbook case of myeloma. Before we knew about the translocations and everything else, it would be the classic elderly male with a sizable percent of plasma cells in the bone marrow with trisomies with hyperdiploid myeloma, kappa type, like everything just fits perfect into the textbook definition of hyperdiploid myeloma. Clinically, we know these are patients that respond very well to IMiDs. And I'm seeing someone who's 79, sure enough, is active, but, thinking about one of the options of what might be considered for his treatment.
So you'd be thinking about what, lenalidomide?
Lenalidomide, low-dose dexamethasone. If I didn't know anything else, and you know, more might come through the history, but right now that would be probably my choice.
Ravi, what would you be thinking?
I would do the same. I think in older individuals, I so far have not adopted three-drug regimens that much. Certainly, if patients have renal insufficiency, that's where I think that producing a response promptly is of essence, and even in older individuals will give a three-drug regimen, in that case, usually with bortezomib, cyclophosphamide and dexamethasone, but otherwise, lenalidomide and dexamethasone. This one would be my.
And Raphael, what would you be thinking about in terms of duration of treatment?
So that's a great question. If the patient tolerates it, probably would be chronic therapy with lenalidomide and low-dose dexamethasone. Now, for most of our patients, I would start, again, standard doses, probably with some tapering of steroids starting at 6 months, and then oftentimes discontinuation of steroids at 12 months, but continuation of lenalidomide as long as the patient seems to tolerate and continues to respond.
So, Gracie, can you follow up with the patient?
Okay. I did treat him with three drugs, bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. I also gave him Zometa. So the urine spike has decreased from 85 to 21. His skeletal survey actually showed improvement in the humerus and femurs. Skull lesions were still present. His urine total protein also has come down from 32 to 11.6.
And how did he tolerate treatment?
He tolerated extremely well.
And you use a classic RVD regimen with a twice-a-week bortezomib.
Yes.
And so now, Raphael, he comes to you for a second opinion at this point.
So I think that's a perfectly legitimate regimen to use in a patient like this. The applause would be, and now knowing that he did well, of course, the patient's getting, quote-unquote, the extra punch of that proteasome inhibitor combination. So maybe the depth of the response that was achieved would be greater than what could have been achieved with R alone, but depending on how long the patient has been on therapy, I would then transition just to discontinue the bortezomib and continue with lenalidomide and dexamethasone. And in this patient, this one is, you know, with very rare exceptions, I wouldn't consider collection of stem cells or anything else, but rather just continuation on the same treatment. And just one caveat, which I forgot to mention initially, this patient sometimes can have somewhat stubborn myeloma, so it's sort of indolent enough that it doesn't respond very well. So if the patient did not achieve a CR, I wouldn't necessarily be disappointed because a hyperdeployed elderly could go on for a very long period of time just with lenalidomide and dexamethasone alone.
So what's this patient's current situation and what are you thinking about for the future?
So he's very active and he's tolerating the treatments well. And I'm also thinking about cutting down on his treatment, but he still has active disease. So my question is, if I cut it down and I see that things are going in the wrong direction, what would be my choice at that point?
Well, I guess one option would be to stop treatment and then see what happens. And if indeed it does go up, then, you know, one could consider reinitiation of the bortezomib. We don't have widespread availability of assays for cell proliferation. And, you know, we still practice and use sometimes the labeling index where you could look at plasma cells. And, you know, if we had a great assay that you could do a bone marrow and you show that the plasma cells are there, but they don't seem to be very proliferative, then I guess more the reason to think about just continuation with lenalidomide and dexamethasone.
So it was also mentioned that he's on zoledronic acid, and Ravi, this brings up that issue, duration of treatment, and whether or not you use bisphosphonates, specifically ZDA, in people without bone disease.
So certainly I'd use zoledronic acid in patients who have either a skeletal survey demonstrated bone disease or have evidence on other scans like MRI or PET scans. I usually at the moment have not been using it in patients who don't have frank lytic lesions. However, you could go by the MRC trial data that seems to suggest that it benefited even those patients. In that regard, the packet insert for the drug does not mandate that patients have lytic lesions. That is approved for patients who have multiple myeloma. As regards the duration of therapy, I still at the moment follow the current ASCO guidelines of monthly therapy for 2 years. However, given the survival advantage in the MRC trial that was independent of its effects on skeletal-related events, I, instead of stopping, will often give it less frequently at that point, switch to every 2 months or every 3 month administration of the drug and try to continue it long term. But I think that, once again, this is an area where there is a lot of difference in practice patterns. And I don't know if one approach is the right one.
So we'll ask your co-investigator, Dr. Fonseca, same issue, use without bone disease and duration of treatment with bone disease.
Yeah, you know, it's a tough question. So I don't really use it like Dr. Vish on patients who have no evidence, overt evidence of lytic bone lesions. And overt, obviously, because if you start taking biopsies or looking at the bone at the microscopy level, almost all patients with myeloma have some evidence of ongoing damage. The counter of that is, I personally think there's limited to no value in a patient who achieves a very stringent, you know, CR or CR post-transplant. So I guess we practice for 2 years, but if we take a patient that comes to us and gets a great induction and a transplant, and then we see them at day 100 and there's no evidence of myeloma, I truly question the need of continuing the bisphosphonate in that setting versus saving it potentially for later down the line. Because there's a fact in myelomas, if there's no plasma cells, there's no bone destruction. And whether you want to burn those chips at that point and indeed put the risk of, you know, osteonecrosis or renal damage, I'm not sure is good return on investment. So I personally do not restart bisphosphonates on patients who have excellent responses post-transplant.
So just, you know, pulling back a little bit more globally, Ravi, in terms of looking at the older patient, the non-transplant situation like this man, can you talk a little bit about how you go about choosing initial systemic therapy, how it varies with age, and what you do about preemptive dose reduction based on age?
Sure. So I think that in older individuals, unless the patient has high-risk myeloma, I do prefer lenalidomide-based therapy. Oral agents are usually preferred by older individuals who want to avoid having to come to the physician's office. And at the moment, there is no data to suggest that a three-drug induction is better than a two-drug lenalidomide dex-based induction. The data on dose reductions is not well worked out, but there was a good review article published by Dr. Palumbo and Dr. Ken Anderson in the New England Journal that has a table which suggests dose modifications for patients who are older than certain age limits, which I think is a good way to practice if one has no data to go by. That was not evidence-based medicine, but I think was a very rational attempt at guiding the choice of doses for individuals who are older. I do certainly dose reduce a little more aggressively, no matter what dose I start at, for patients who are older, because their tolerance of the drugs is, I think, less than younger individuals.
So same question back to you, Rafael. How do you approach the older patient?
Well, just to complement what hasn't been said, I don't tend to dose reduce right off the get-go, but one has to be very attentive. A great example of this is the French study, usually referred to as the Houlin study, which was for elderly patients treated with MPT, where you saw 30% myelosuppression. So this is with thalidomide. Most people don't think about thalidomide being myelosuppressive. So I don't really dose reduce up front, but I think one has to be quite vigilant with the elderly patient.
What about duration of therapy, Ravi, in the non-transplant situation? The argument's been made by Dr. Palumbo and others that what we're really looking for is longer-term, more tolerable treatment. Is that philosophy something you're embracing?
Partially. I think that it hasn't been conclusively demonstrated that treatment continuously is any better than treating to best response and giving a break. I can understand the rationale for continued maintenance therapy, but when it's not evidence-based, then I'm not dogmatic about it, especially if a patient wishes to get a break or is exhibiting side effects. I have a low threshold to stop therapy. I think only time will tell whether maintenance is truly required. There are a couple of trials that are looking at this issue where lenalidomide especially is being given more long-term versus in an abbreviated course, and perhaps they will give us more scientific data to base our recommendation on.
So Warren, why don't we talk about the 74-year-old man?
So this is a 74-year-old who had been in excellent health, who presented with right hip pain, and was found to have a 3-centimeter mass in his upper femur. He underwent a biopsy, which confirmed a Kappa-restricted plasmacytoma. He then underwent further workup. He had a bone marrow that showed 30% plasma cells with an 11-14 translocation and a 1Q duplication by FISH. His chemistry, CBC, calcium were all normal. He had mildly decreased IgG levels, but a normal SPEP. No monoclonal protein by immunofixation, and he had a mildly elevated kappa free light chain of 9.76 with lambda free light chains of 0.95. His ratio was 10.27. He had a PET CT and MRIs of his spine and pelvis, which were all normal except for the described 3-centimeter right femoral neck lesion.
In terms of the lesion that he had, was there concern about fracture?
Yes.
And what was the orthopedic input on it?
Yeah, so he got seen down at the University of Miami and was recommended to have prophylactic surgical pinning.
So he had that done?
Yes.
And so now, Raphael, we're post-op. What would you be thinking in terms of radiation therapy as well as systemic therapy?
Sure. Well, if you take a step back and say, okay, 10 years ago, you see this patient and you could very well and justifiably say, we're going to start therapy and we're going to treat this patient back then with, you know, melphalan, prednisone or whatever combination. Or nowadays I could say, you know, I'm going to treat this patient with one of the new RD or bortezomib, melphalan and prednisone, something like that. But today we know a lot more about myeloma. And I think here's a person who has a single lesion, a plasmacytoma, that is creating need for therapy locally. There's no question about it. But the question that's sort of crossing my mind, is this someone who has sort of the tip of an iceberg, but in general seems to be more of a smoldering myeloma for other reasons? And again, I'd say that 10 years ago, because now we have a PET scan that shows only activity where the person has a lesion. So the thought would cross my mind, particularly in someone who potentially we're not going to take through transplant, should we consider radiation and perhaps either observation of some form of a chronic mild therapy versus just, you know, crossing the Rubicon and going full force with systemic forms of therapy? And again, here might be a situation where something like the labeling index could be useful, looking at the bone marrow, perhaps risk stratification. But it is possible that the plasma cells in the bone marrow are for the most part quiescent, and we just have an outburst of, you know, a rogue clone that is now creating this in the femur. So in the absence of any other area of end organ damage with a low kappa free light chain, I could go either way, and I could be easily swayed to say, let's treat with local treatment only and observe the patient closely.
Ravi?
For most part, I would agree. However, I don't entirely in a 74-year-old rule out stem cell transplant as a therapy, either immediately or potentially even in the future. I must admit, I take very few people that age to transplant. Of the proportion that are referred to me, the majority, I suggest going forth with regular treatment, but I think that that is one thing that I wouldn't totally negate. As regards non-transplant therapy, if it's decided that patient is not a transplant candidate, though I wouldn't be averse to waiting, I generally would go ahead and treat the patient, and perhaps with lenalidomide and dexamethasone once again being the agent of choice after the initial local attention to the hip.
So what's the current situation? What did you end up doing?
So you actually went to see one of your colleagues, Vince Rajkumar.
Okay.
And when I saw him, my recommendation was that he get postoperative radiation therapy to the right hip and then lenalidomide, dexamethasone, and that he got the same recommendation from Vince. And he was also a proactive person. He was not going to feel too comfortable, you know, kind of watching this, because I think by definition in the jury salmon, it'd have stage one myeloma. And the other question is whether the 1q duplication by FISH in this setting is of any importance, or even not in this setting, what is the significance of a 1q duplication by FISH?
So 1q abnormalities have been noted in several studies, primarily through the University of Arkansas, to be associated with more aggressive disease. Now, it's not clear whether duplication is the same thing as an amplification, and I would probably just take it with a grain of salt. To counterbalance that, the patient has a T1114, which is usually associated with better outcome and better responsiveness to therapy. So I didn't put too much weight on that finding on the 1Q amplification. I guess one point for discussion, you know, say the patient goes and gets a consultation, has had the surgery. I would then say if the patient goes into systemic therapy and the surgery has been successful, do we need the radiation therapy? And that would be another, you know, and I don't think it's wrong if the patient gets it by and large, but if that has been surgically corrected and now you're going to start systemic therapy, another option would be just to go with lenalidomide and low doses of dexamethasone. Now, I think that Ravi's comment is very important. You know, having not seen the patient, don't know, because we do see transplant patients in the 74. And I think, you know, the recommendation is perfectly fine. Not to minimize, I mean, every single drug has side effects and every single drug needs to have management. But having said that, this is probably a very simple and non-intrusive way of treating this particular patient.
So and bisphosphonates as well. Bisphosphonates?
I don't know. I sit on the fence on that one. I probably would provide the patient with bisphosphonates because he had this first lesion, but I would just see how he does.
Yeah. Why would you hesitate?
Well, the patient has a single lesion. And historically, if you didn't have the PET scan, and you know, a lot of these patients were considered like solitary bone plasmacytoma. And admittedly, the bone marrow shows that 30% plasma cells in the background. But we don't know if they're active or they're just, you know, hibernating there waiting for their opportunity to mutate. So this is when I would sit on the fence whether I would use bisphosphonates or not. You know, still 74, has to come for a monthly infusion. And, you know, if the person is reliable, I would be comfortable observing without bisphosphonates.
I'm just kind of curious, sort of globally looking at him, could you envision him going to transplant?
Yes, I mean, he's in excellent health. And he asked me, would he be considered transplant eligible? And I said, yes. I said, every center has a different age cutoff. I think when I was at WashU with Ravi, I think we even transplanted patients up to 75. So I told him I wouldn't discount him purely on age, but obviously it was up to a transplant center because he otherwise had no comorbid diseases, in excellent health.
Any other thoughts or questions about this case?
I think one of the other things I would ask Rafael is that, you know, I've heard you mention before that it's actually those patients who have the 11-14 that are more likely to have bone disease, and some of the more aggressive translocations like 414 perhaps sometimes are so aggressive that they develop fast and don't even develop the bone disease.
Yeah, that's true. If you look at 414, half of the patients with 414 have no lytic lesions. And those are patients that tend to present earlier in life. So I guess one of the hypotheses is that they don't really have had enough time to develop lytic bone lesions. In the contrary, the extreme example is just what we talked before, the hyperdiploid. So the more indolent myeloma, more time of plasma cells in contact to the bone, so more damage to the bone. So that's also something else to consider.
I mean, in some of my most aggressive myeloma patients have 11-14s, and I know by gene array profiling, there's a distinct group of 11-14s that do behave very aggressively.
That's a very, very good point. And I know this can get confusing. And Neil, we've talked about this before, because once you get into all the subtypes, the 11-14 is usually a good citizen, except...
Totally over my head.
Except that sometimes in the wrong context of the secondary mutation, these are the most aggressive patients. So a majority of patients with plasma cell leukemia can have an 11-14. And some of the most aggressive myeloma in the younger patients have this 11-14. The gene signature can separate it into the group CD1, CD2, and whether you have CD20 expression or not. So yeah, everything has to be taken with a grain of salt. And again, this is just one more example where individualized medicine, again, forget about whole genome sequencing, just all these features being put together to make a recommendation about treatment for the patient.
Raymond.
I'm not a pathologist, and so the reason I'm asking this question, if you have an 11-14 and a CD20 positive, how do you know it's not mantle cell?
It's a very, very good question. So mantle cell and myeloma, and I've seen actually patients in consultation where there's been confusion between a lymphoid disorder and myeloma. So in general, the flow cytometry should be able to tell you mantle cell from myeloma just because of the CD5 positivity. And they usually would be CD23 positive, CD22 dim. Whereas myeloma would rarely, if ever, be CD5 positive, and the other markers would be positive, but
38 and 138. On.
Right, and the presence of a monoclonal protein, but you could again have a free light chain or a non-secretor. The morphology, if I see a FISH image that shows a fusion and shows scant cytoplasm, you can think myeloma. And it gets very interesting because it's very common. 50% of patients with light chain amyloidosis have 11-14. It's very common in the IgM form of myeloma, which is very, very rare. But it has just this lymphoid, you know, appearance that can make it confusing with lymphoid disorders.
So if you have a myeloma that has CD20 positive, I'm not familiar with those. Have they done any trials to see if rituximab is of any benefit in that patient?
So there are some trials and there are some anecdotal experience. The anecdotal I know of was in a smoldering patient who responded nicely to rituximab, someone who, quote unquote, didn't want to do anything with toxic chemotherapy, but then accepted rituximab. Not like rituximab is completely free of risks or side effects, as we know.
Did it work?
It did work on that patient. But there was a French trial where they look at CD20 myeloma, and it didn't work that well. But then the question is myeloma more like, you know, follicular lymphoma, or is it more like diffuse large cell lymphoma? So could it be that you could treat, you know, RVD or CyBorD plus rituximab in CD20 myeloma? And as our good colleague and friend Sagar Lonial says, myeloma still is the only disease that produces a monoclonal antibody and has no therapeutic monoclonal antibody against it.
But I think there's also a body of evidence for those who believe in it that there's a stem cell that is possibly CD20 positive. And so there have actually been prospective trials. I think the John Hopkins group has been one of the leaders in this area exploring rituximab as a therapy. And the data that they presented at the ASBMT meeting did not show any convincing activity in terms of paraprotein responses. However, they did some nifty assays trying to show the impact in vitro on what they defined as their stem cell population and showed that it was possibly impacted. And their conjecture was that if you had a readout that was more long-term, that it could possibly have an impact.
So what about elotuzumab and other monoclonal antibodies?
Sure. So elotuzumab is a monoclonal antibody, recognizes this molecule, which seems to be largely restricted to myeloma cells, the CS1. And the preliminary data is quite interesting, I would say, particularly in combination with lenalidomide and dexamethasone. So the studies are expanding to formally test whether it's going to add to the efficacy of that regimen. The short of it is that the phase 2 response rate and depth of response was better than historic. So now that's being tested in the phase 3 clinical trial. There's other trials as well with bortezomib. I don't see that much of a signal. But again, it's just still phase 2 clinical trial. So we're going to have to see where that goes.
Just maybe a quick question, sort of pointing towards the future, Ravi. Obviously, IMiDs and proteasome inhibitors have revolutionized the treatment of this disease. And when you're talking about ADCs or maybe some other strategies, anything out there that you think 5 years from now maybe is going to be another component to move the field forward measurably that you see right now?
I'm actually very impressed with elotuzumab. I've got a fair amount of experience with it. I think that I'm very impressed with the durability of the responses. Some of the earliest patients that went on the drug with lenalidomide and dexamethasone are more than 3 years out with very stable disease. Most of them have very small paraproteins, but they're not progressing. So it's remarkable. The durability of the response is what I'm very impressed by. So I think that that could be a major advance in the therapy of myeloma. Other than that, I think there are a number of compounds that have shown single agent activity, the CD56 conjugated antibody. I had been a believer that you have to show single agent activity before you really will find a place in the treatment of myeloma, but my experience with elotuzumab has made me reconsider that paradigm because as a single agent, it had no activity. And it is thought that perhaps the ADCC effect of lenalidomide is what has made it active. The fruits of genomic research will hopefully one day pay dividends as well. That's the other big hope out there.
So any thoughts, questions? Chuck?
Can we speak a little about amyloidosis?
Sure.
We were talking about filters for acute renal failure earlier. And when you treat a patient with myeloma, I mean, the goal, it's twofold, to remove the cancer cell and also to get rid of the protein. And in the case of amyloid, obviously the protein is not catabolized that well. Mm-hmm. Aside from preventing new protein from being deposited, can you really reverse the effects of amyloid?
No, in the old days, we used to think of amyloid something that was very hard to reverse and something, in fact, had a worse prognosis than myeloma. Things, first of all, dramatically changed with the advent of stem cell transplant. And particularly stem cell transplant and patients who achieve a hematologic response have actually pretty good outcomes. In some series, a Mayo Clinic series that was reported at the ASH last year, 40% of patients who had a hematologic response with a single transplant had no evidence of progressive disease at 10 years. That was pretty darn good for those patients who can get there. And with proper patient selection, that has dropped down the mortality of the procedure itself. Now, in blood, we have a paper where we use bortezomib, cyclophosphamide, and dexamethasone as treatment for amyloidosis. And we started using this empirically on patients who wouldn't be really fit for transplant, patients who were too sick for transplant. The conclusion was 75% CR, most of the CRs within a cycle or two. And many of these patients, I am certain, we would be holding their hands as they go through the process of deterioration and ultimately death for the amyloidosis. One very notable one, a patient of mine who's a nurse, who had jaundice and cardiac failure and just the most severe amyloid you can imagine. Now she's, you know, back to a relatively normal lifestyle. So much so she's actually become a spokesperson for some of the support organizations. So we started using a lot of the combination of bortezomib, cyclophosphamide, and dexamethasone. The, you know, question is whether we still do the transplant or not. But to your point, I use this analogy and I find this very helpful with patients because explaining what amyloid is to patients can be a very long process. So I tell them, you know, think of amyloidosis as smoke damage. The smoke is a protein we measure in your blood, but the fire is in the bone marrow. And our goal is to put the smoke down to zero. And that's why we attack the fire with chemotherapy. And in time, your body will get better. And now there's good data that things such as cardiac function can get better. You know, hepatomegaly clearly gets better. Proteinuria can get better. Renal failure doesn't really improve. The creatinine tends to stay where it is. But I would say the outcome is far better for patients than what it was 5 and 10 years ago.
Chuck, what's your perception about how amyloid is viewed by general oncologists in practice?
they would, you know, put in the family of multiple myeloma, but they would tell you that it's, you know, some people don't even believe that treating the myeloma will really impact on the underlying amyloid. So that's why I was asking specifically about the reversal and improvement in end organ function. And, you know, I think once the kidneys are shot, they're shot, but...
Yeah, the kidneys are, when you lose renal function, that doesn't come back. And that has to do with the displacement of amyloid and the deposits and ischemia that you have. So that doesn't come back. But just the protein resorption is a very long process, but patients do get better with time. And, you know, there's some things that, again, can get better, including cardiac function. Some of this people think has to do with reactive oxygen species that are associated with the sort of catabolism of the light chains. But with time, some of these patients seem to be doing quite well.
One of the patients I had with amyloid had fragility in their blood vessels to a point where they just developed these humongous bruises and you have to replace the blood products and such. And I have a hard time giving lenalidomide because you have to give aspirin with it and they're bruising when you touch them, you know. When you treat amyloid, is there anything that you guys, any special regimens, or do you just say, okay, we'll just go put up with the bruising? Or do you use Cyborg D for the amyloid? Is that your standard now?
That's our standard now, and we just hold hands. And for some of them, it's truly biting the bullet because of some of the issues that you mentioned. We tend to be quite liberal about rapidly reducing the steroids. Fluid management can be a major problem with these patients. And we've had some patients who are very sick who end up, you know, some of them even have ended up in the hospital. But with time, a lot of these patients do get better. But it is a challenge. And, you know, that vascular fragility, I don't think you can do anything in the short term other than just, you know, waiting for the long term for things to get better.
No, I agree. I think that certainly we still do stem cell transplants if they're thought to be transplant eligible. In patients who are transplant eligible, it's not clear whether any kind of induction in that setting is necessary. But I've been very impressed with bortezomib-based responses. I've seen paradoxically neuropathy, which is the major manifestation of the disease, get better with bortezomib. We've certainly seen decreases in BNP, the decreases in the troponin fraction. We've seen, if you do serial echoes, a reduction in the interventricular septum. So certainly, reversal of the disease is very feasible.
Now, with the fragility that I'm talking about, do you use the sub-Q bortezomib or do you use the IV bortezomib?
Most of the patients we treated were with the IV version still.
Okay.
You know, some patients describe, I have a patient who said that he had like pins and needles in the eyes with every one of those bruises. And I think of the vessels, they're like waxy structures now, and they break and they bruise, and it's just really a very uncomfortable thing for patients.
Okay, because I don't know where to weigh the neuropathy versus the problems with the bruising, so I didn't know. So you always use the IV form
We've
still?
Used the IV. I don't really have enough experience with sub-Q and the Cyborg D and amyloidosis. I would presume the bleeding is probably going to be more so, but I don't know.
I've given it to some patients sub-Q, but not all patients bruise. Obviously, if you have a patient where bruising is a major manifestation, you may be wanting to give it intravenously. But I've given it subcutaneous to some patients with amyloid.
I can't tell you how many patients I get referred who have neuropathy, see a neurologist as part of their standard template. They order immunoelectrophoresis, and I have all these people in their 80s with neuropathy. And a significant portion of older people will have an MGUS, and I don't know if the neuropathy is really related to it. And I certainly loathe to put these patients on therapy for myeloma when they have a low amplitude protein, and I think it's really an incidental finding for the majority of these people, and I don't have a test to determine if the paraprotein is responsible for the neuropathy, so I'm in a bit of a quandary.
It's one of the consults I dislike the most, because what you really are asking at the end of the day, should I do a nerve biopsy to know whether the person needs therapy or not? And most of these are elderly patients. So I go by a couple of things. Is the neuropathy severe enough that you think it's going to require therapy? So forget about the hematology. If the patient will require therapy because, you know, severe peripheral neuropathy, well, then maybe go through the workup. And the second one is the nature of the protein. For the most part, it's IgM associated with a peripheral neuropathy. And I think much lower likelihood of suspicion if it's non-IgM, and then much less likely to engage on a major workup. Can you know for sure? Absolutely not. The only way of knowing this is doing a biopsy of the nerve. It's a pretty involved procedure, and I don't do a lot of biopsies, and that's what I do. But it's a consult that always leaves you a little bit with uncertainty about what you're doing.